Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth. And James, it's Brexit that's leading the news today. We had David Frost's speech yesterday on the Northern Ireland Protocol, and today we're going to be hearing from the EU. What's at stake here? David Frost, the minister charged with the protocol, it was really calling for a complete rewrite.
David Frost is trying to suggest that what is at stake here is whether the UK and the EU can get out of this rut, I think you could say, in relations where everything is tense and the two sides are snapping at each other on a very regular basis. His argument was, if you could fix the protocol, you fix the biggest irritant in UK-EU relations and you allow them to have more constructive relations going forward. At the end of his speech, he says, look, the challenges facing the West are so great that we can't all be divided on these issues. Let's going to try and move beyond that. Now, I think the tension is going to come in that the EU feel, hang on a second, you guys signed this agreement just 2 years ago, and the EU feels that its offer is, in the phrase they've used in their briefings overnight, is at the outer edges of EU law, and that they can't go that much further. I think things are a little bit hopeful. I think we're clearly in a negotiating space rather than an immediate UK trigger of Article 16 or anything like that. And I think that you can, with imagination, see how, even this ECJ red line you could resolve. It's worth noting that the UK-EU trade and cooperation agreement that has a kind of role for the ECJ, but the role for the ECJ there is in interpreting EU law, and there's a kind of initial buffer zone before you get to the ECJ. I think there's some talk, Katia Adler was talking about a Swiss version, which is in their relations with the EU, which is not dissimilar. Sorry, Katia Adler, the BBC's Europe editor, because not everyone listens to other podcasts. And so I mean, there are options here, but I think that you saw in Leo Varadkar's comments following Dominic Cummings' tweets that, the tensions that lie just beneath the surface and how this could very quickly turn into even more rancorous proceedings if the two sides are not careful.
And when it comes to David Frost, James, he tends to have a reputation for inflaming tensions with the EU rather than soothing them. But yet, I was struck in his speech yesterday, the initial reaction it received in terms of diplomats, EU diplomats, was that it was a bit more constructive than normal. So do you think that despite obviously saying it completely has to go, there is a sense that David Frost is currently in, diplomat mode and there is space to negotiate?
I think the speech was milder mannered than people had expected. I thought it made clearer something that I think the UK government does want, but it's sometimes very bad at communicating, but it does want a better relationship with the EU than the one it currently has in terms of tone and substance. And I thought it was also interesting that he was explicit that, look, they're not just trying to have a permanent argument about Brexit for political purposes. My strong feeling is that on this point, the Tory Party can attack the Labour Party for wanting to undo Brexit. So, for example, they can say that Keir Starmer wanting 100,000 visas for lorry drivers, for HGV drivers, is an attempt to kind of resurrect free movement or the like. But if they go into the next election saying Brexit isn't done, that I don't think is a winner for them. I mean, in the 2019 general election, the sense very much was get Brexit done. You remember that ad the Tories kind of bought the whole of the kind of YouTube homepage to show people in the UK days before the election was all about just end the arguing. Everyone is fed up with this subject and they want it resolved so that the country can move on. So I don't think this argument that kind of constantly having arguments with the EU is an unalloyed political good for the Johnson government. I don't think that's right.
And yet, on the subject of things to argue about, James, there's plenty. In Dominic Cummings has been intervening into the debate. So we have had the Prime Minister's former advisor suggesting that it was always the plan to tear up the Brexit deal in terms of the Northern Ireland Protocol aspect. That's now led to an angry reaction from those on the Brussels side. We've also had Ireland's Deputy Prime Minister warning that ultimately the UK is a country that doesn't keep its word. So what's going on with that intervention? Not particularly helpful for the government.
I think I don't think number 10 are particularly thrilled that this intervention has happened. I think that one thing that is worth saying is that not that he means to, but Dominic Cummings essentially acquits Boris Johnson of any attempt to mislead, saying that Boris Johnson didn't know what he was signing or what was going on and wasn't in on this plan. So, you know, so in some ways you could say, but I think this does come down to a point, which is one of the big tensions throughout this process has been the UK side have said, oh, look, we signed the protocol, but the way the protocol has been implemented has caused problems. Article 16, or the EU's threat to use Article 16 over vaccines completely changed the dynamics, and everything that was fine beforehand was not fine. There have been lots of people on the EU side and lots of people in Dublin who thought, not so sure about this, think that they've always were planning to kind of perfidious Albion, was always planning to renege on this. And I think these Cummings tweets play into that, and I mean I think it adds another challenge to the UK government, which is to say to people, look, if the UK and the EU came to a negotiated settlement on changes to the protocol, could you be sure that the UK would accept them and they wouldn't come back for more in a few years' time? I think they're going to zoom out, though. One thing which is true is here is it's quite clear that when you look at the leaders of the unionist parties in Northern Ireland, the protocol in its current form no longer commands their confidence. You know, Doug Beattie, the new leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, you know, this is a guy who is trying to push for a very different, one might say, less negative form of unionism than you've seen before. In his speech at the Ulster Unionist Party conference at the weekend, he said, you know, look, you don't persuade people by wrapping yourself in the flag. He's made a big effort to be inclusive. This might not seem like a big deal here, but I think it is in the context of Northern Ireland. You know, in the latest Ulster Unionist Party political broadcast, you know, features kids playing hurling. You know, these are all big attempts at kind of trying to kind of square some of these identity circles in Northern Ireland. You know, the fact that even he finds the current situation so untenable, I think, is a sign that if you are talking about Northern Ireland in terms of, you know, the Good Friday Agreement and a political settlement that both communities are happy with, the protocol is clearly not succeeding on that front. And I think there is an argument that the protocol is trying to do two things. It's trying to both ensure that the integrity of the single market was protected and also that the Belfast Agreement was protected, and that you could argue that the way that the protocol is currently framed and working is not balanced between those two objectives. But I think the UK would be wise to adopt a more emollient and less confrontational tone in trying to get changes, because you are asking to renegotiate a deal that this government signed, that this Prime Minister signed, even in diplomatic terms, very recently.
And just finally, we had the news that Matt Hancock has got a job. This is the former health secretary who obviously quit relating to a COVID breach involving one of his advisors. But his new role is with the United Nations as a special representative, helping Africa's economy recover from COVID. James, it was striking to me how publicly, ultimately, lots of cabinet ministers were celebrating this appointment, taking to social media to say, congratulations, Matt Hancock. Do you think this is the start of things to come? There's been various briefings about how Matt Hancock does believe he'll be in cabinet before too long.
I think it's been clear from Matt Hancock since he quit the government that you know he hasn't given up on coming back. I mean, that was clear, I think, in the exchange of letters that he had with Boris Johnson when he resigned. And I think him taking on this UN job is another sign that he hasn't given up on his political ambitions, that he still wants to come back. And I think you are also right. It is interesting that the kind of, you know, you had the new Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, you know, coming out to say, oh, isn't this a kind of what good news it was. So I think it does suggest that, you know, he is not regarded as being kind of beyond the pale by lots of his former cabinet colleagues. I think in terms of coming back in politics, always the question is, you know, and I think his allies are also relieved that the initial COVID select committee report that you write about in the Eye this morning, Katie, you know, no one comes out of it well, but I think it's fair to say that it isn't particularly critical of him compared to others. But I also think that, you know, reshuffles are, you know, we've just had one. I suspect the next one is quite some way away, and there's probably a bit of time to go before you get there. But I think there's probably a bit of time to go before you are in a situation where, you know, he could be considered for kind of full rehabilitation, if you see what I mean.
Now, of course, we never know who will have to resign or perhaps even be sacked between now and the next reshuffle for reasons outside of Boris Johnson's control. Thank you, James, and thank you for listening.